And another episode. How have you been?
Good. It's been, my microphone's kind of far away, but
there you go.
It's been a pretty good week, man. I mean, we both finished up some of our early decision deadlines for some schools and early action deadlines. So we're back on track, but a lot of stuff has happened this week. I was at work today. I worked a 5-hour shift and I was just researching a bunch of stuff on New York Times and just trying to find out as much as I could about, you know, the Biden administration and the infrastructure bill and stuff like that. So I think there's a lot of stuff we can discuss today. But, you know, with my life, I've just been extremely busy as always. I think it's probably going to ease off come second semester, but I've been super busy with homework and deadlines and stuff like that. And it's been pretty stressful, but I've found time to have fun with Halloween happening yesterday. I just was with my friends yesterday having a little hangout, and then I hung out on Friday. So it's been a struggle balancing it, but I've been able to do it a little bit. How about
that's,
you?
That's what I've noticed too. Like, the balance has been something that's so hard, especially like I've been stressed. I've had so much to do. It's been insane. I was out. And so like last week was all catching up, like coming in early to finish things, staying late after school, studying for a test. I had like, there was a day where I literally, or there was 2 days in a row where I had a, you know, to make up an exam in the morning, take an exam in first period, take an exam in second period, and then take an exam in either fourth or third. So the studying was crazy. So my goal for this week and like this weekend was kind of just like survive that, like get B's on these tests, get B's on these quizzes, because now we're like in the final stretch. Like I didn't want to tank. I wasn't trying to, you know, stress myself out. And because I was worried that if I try to get A's or try to get like super, super good grades on these things, I would sacrifice one grade for another, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
So instead I studied a little bit for each one, just trying to survive.
Yeah, I got that.
So that I can make it. And then now I'm like getting into this routine. I've been trying to sleep. Okay. You remember at the beginning of the year when we had the resolutions?
Oh yeah.
Those lasted like 3 days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no. But we talked about meeting every single day and then sleeping for how many hours, we said?
I think it was just waking up at 5.
Yeah, waking up at 5 o'clock. That was
I think day. That's what it was. I don't know if it was sleeping for a certain amount of time.
No, but you're right. But I planned, I mean, like me with the deadline, I planned to sleep like a little bit earlier, like 9 or 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
And wake up at 5 and then like do some stuff before school so I'm able to be more productive. But that didn't last because, you know, one of the issues I've had recently is because my body is just so tired in the mornings, no matter when I sleep, to where like I just cannot wake up for some reason. And it's been new this year compared to previous years, but I feel like it's just all the fatigue catching up on me in the mornings, just because I wake up at 6:30 at the latest because I have clubs in the morning. So I definitely find it hard to wake up earlier than 6:30 because I'm forced to wake up then, and I just, my body will not let me wake up before that time. It's like a mental, like a body regulating clock, if that makes sense.
Yeah. But so I was trying to sleep at 10 p.m. And, you know, I think a big influence on that was the unit that we're doing in psychology right now, where it was like, you know, it's all about sleep and whatnot. We're doing like a sleep journal. And so like I tried sleeping at 10 p.m. That lasted like 2 days. I do, however, wake up at 6 a.m. The thing is, there was this one day where I fell asleep at 10 p.m. and I woke up at 6. I came downstairs at like 6:10 after washing my... I've been washing my face every single day, like morning and night now. I've been getting into some really good habits. I've been working out. I've been running again, which is something that I'm really proud of. I stopped running. I stopped working out, but I'm getting back into it. Anyways, so I woke up at 6 a.m. after getting like 8 hours of sleep. I came down here. I turned on a candle. I studied, I played like some like smooth jazz. I got ready for the day. Like I studied beforehand and it felt so good. And like throughout the day, I was in such a good mood. And then I had like all this stuff to do. And it's like, there's no way that you can sleep at 10 p.m. and be a successful student. Like you have to sacrifice one or the other. Or your time management has to, like your time management has to be so on the dot, where like you're studying the perfect amount, doing the same routine every single day, and that's just not possible.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I've learned, you know, being in high school, is that one of the best, you know, time management tools is spacing things out like over a week. Like, for example, if you have a test on Friday, spacing it out with studying from Monday through Friday will help a lot.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's kind of hard for a lot of students because we tend to procrastinate so much.
True.
And so the majority of us are just going to like wait till Thursday and then study there. But yep. I've been learning that it's really important to space your studying out to make sure you're not stressed on one day. And also that you're making sure that you're getting things done and you're not having to stay up till like 12 or past that. But the issue with seniors like me and you is that we also have work to add into it. So it's not just clubs and school, but now it's going to a job and then coming back. So it adds another factor, which makes it even harder.
And that was the thing with the podcast. That was the thing with the podcast too. It was like, it's not even that we didn't want to do it. It's just the schedule was so crazy. And I mean, right now it's crazy too, but we've kind of gotten into a routine and we're okay with I feel like I'm okay with dealing with it. Like I've accepted the fact that I'm going to be sleep deprived. Like I don't know. I was driving earlier today and I was like, oh man, I can't wait home to get a nap. Can't wait to get home to take a nap. Can you tell I'm tired? And then I was just like, there's no point in being tired. Like I'm going to take a nap. I'm going to wake up tomorrow. I'm going to be tired too. Like I might as well just be productive, do something, try to get stuff done. Like screw taking a nap. Like let's just get stuff done. So I worked out. Here I am doing a podcast. After this, I'm probably gonna study because I'm trying to space out my studying. But even then, even when you space out your studying, it's so hard when you're taking all these like crazy classes, doing work, doing a podcast, doing clubs. I mean, just work alone. And you know, I mean, it's so much. It's so much.
Yeah. And I saw Dr. Bearden last week. I toured him around the school. If you guys remember, we had an interview with Dr. Bearden last year before school opened up, talking about the possibility of a mask mandate. And that was a pretty productive conversation, I would say. And then Damien, I was able to speak with the Board of Commissioners for Forsyth County Schools. And he was able to speak about the diversity, equity, and inclusion plan that they were, they had been passed before. And parents were speaking against that. But Damien was fighting back against those parents. And so Dr. Bearden ended up sticking with that plan, you know, even amidst parents wanting to get rid of it. And that's something I commend him on. We talked a lot in our school about the importance of just maintaining people's focus upon CTE and career-focused academies because, like, Alliance, our school, if you guys know, it's in Forsyth County, Georgia, and we learn a lot about different pathways of learning. So we have like a law pathway where we can just be in a courtroom, which me and Damien are in. We graduated from that. And we have like different pathways based upon your skills. And the benefit of the school is that we're able to have hands-on knowledge and training even before college. And one of the biggest things that people overlook in the political side of things is that a lot of technical education programs like community colleges, they can do so much to give a person a lot of a sustainable income as they grow up. Like, for example, plumbers make an obscene amount of money, even if you don't consider how much money they make. Their skilled trade earns them a lot of money and enough money to sustain and manage themselves and their lifestyle. So I think that, you know, promoting that kind of education is really important just because the majority of people in places like rural Georgia can't afford a four-year university or college. And so community colleges have to be a focus for us going forward. And I think that, you know, to bring it back to politics, President Biden's plan to give people money to finance 2 years of their community college gives people a real chance at earning a lot of money even without the financial, you know, financial money to pay for a four-year degree. And I think the future is moving towards things, educational things outside of a four-year degree, because if you look at the university system, and I know this because my dad works with the universities, he talks a lot about how a lot of what you learn there is not just tangible skills. It's more about, you know, interacting with people, going to clubs, things like that. But I think for the average person, you don't need all that stuff to become a successful person to be like in the future. So I think that it's really important for us to find other forms of education to give people who are less fortunate or have less income the opportunity to gain an income without having to pay an obscene amount of money and being bogged down by student loan debt.
Yeah, and I think that there's a very interesting political figure on the rise here in Georgia. I don't know if you've heard about him. Gary Black. He's running for Senate, but we can talk about that after we roll the intro.
Yeah.
So, go ahead.
I actually met Gary Black this summer.
Did you?
The Governor's Honors Program. Well, I didn't meet him in person, but he was on a Zoom call with all the GHP Governor's Honors Program Social Studies nominees. And so we talked to him. And I'll mention what he said in a later part of our podcast, but it was pretty interesting.
Mention it right after this. Hello, everybody. Yeah. Welcome back to another episode of the Politatine Podcast. My name is Damon Galvin, and as always, I'm joined by my wonderful co-host, Varun.
Hey, everyone. My name is Varun Kadathala. I'm the co-host of the Politatine Podcast here today with Damian for our second episode after a long break, and we're looking forward to bringing you some great content today and thereafter.
So when you met Gary Black, was he already running for Senate? I don't think he was, right?
I think he was hinting at a campaign, but now he's full-fledged running against Raphael Warnock. Yeah.
Have you looked at his policies?
I haven't specifically, but he talked to me about them this summer a little bit. Okay. About his policies.
What did he mention to you?
A lot of stuff was about climate change.
His website is hilarious.
Okay. Yeah, but a lot of our conversation this summer was about climate change and his thoughts on that. And so one of the things that he brought up previously was, it was something about Georgia's weather cycles and how we've been improving in the climate or something like that. I don't remember the exact quote he brought up, but it was really about how weather cycles have been changing, and he basically compared climate change to weather cycles. That's kind of a direct quote from him. And so when he said that, all of the GHP Social Studies nominees were just very surprised that a person running for office who was Commissioner of Agriculture in Georgia had said that climate change was just a component of weather cycles and it wasn't anything man-made. So I think that a lot of the things that were discussed that day were just tainted by the fact that he had denied climate change in front of a crowd of the future, you know, first of all, the future politicians of this state and nation, and also in front of the Governor's Honors Program agriculture science nominees who were also going to be studying that field. And so I think, first of all, it speaks to how he's disillusioned in what climate change is, the facts of man-made climate change. But second of all, it speaks to how much a person of power can influence those who are going to become influential in the field. So for example, if I am a student listening to Gary Black and he tells me that climate change is part of weather patterns, I may be inclined to go as a farmer or as a politician to literally go tell people that that's the case. I think it's really important what our politicians say about certain things, especially when they're talking to students who are highly impressionable. And I realized how important that was that day, because there was a huge debate just about that topic between a lot of different people there. And I realized how a lot of people didn't know that climate change existed and how that resonated with a lot of people, just because somebody who's in that, you know, big of a seat should know that science is true and that climate change exists, but I guess not.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. He's a very Republican. So just some background on him. As Varun mentioned, he is the agriculture commissioner of Georgia since 2011. He was elected in 2010. He's a Republican. His education was from the University of Georgia. And he claims to be building a grassroots movement and identifies himself as a farmer and a politician. I would put comedian in there, or clown, depends on what you want, because his website seems like absolute satire. Actually, our researcher, Julia Hartman, sent this over to me, and she was telling me how much it seems like satire. She did not include this in the research that she sent over to me, but I decided to head over to his webpage and look at some of what he's advocating for. And I want to share this quote with you. Where is it? Okay, this is his stance on illegal immigration. And I want you to find the irony in this. Ready? President Biden and Raphael Warnock's open borders policy has unleashed a national security and public health crisis. Did you find the irony?
Your video lagged, and I thought like you were still speaking, so I was just like listening to what you were saying.
No.
So you said what he said was President Biden and Raphael Warnock's open borders policy is creating a national security and public health crisis.
Yes. Right. A public health crisis. Yeah. Can you guess his stance on COVID?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Of course.
So interesting. Well, obviously he's anti-COVID. Yeah. Like literally one of his things. And he talks about critical race theory on his webpage too, which I think is interesting.
Yeah, I just think that a lot of these points are like conservative talking points.
Exactly.
And that's what's going to draw these people in. So it's like using these buzzwords like COVID and immigration policy, deportation. These things are going to draw conservatives in. That's why he's doing it.
Yeah, it says communist China. That's how he describes China. And so I think that it's so something that he talks about on his webpage was the fact that he's like very pro education, right? He says he married an educator and whatnot. And that he was talking about the technical college. So this is the reason that I brought him in. Earlier you were talking about the technical college. Let me see if I can find his stance here in the in the research. He wants to renew energy independence. Where is it? Okay, maybe it's on his website. Yeah, it's here under education. Oh, he's very pro-life, by the way. It's something that Julia was very upset about. He believed.
And we can also talk about the Texas abortion law later on in this podcast.
We can. You want to know? So, for everything else on his webpage, he has like two or three paragraphs, right? Like explaining his points. Second Amendment. He says, "I prefer Jesus's command: love thy neighbor as thyself." Goes on this big tangent about like backing your constitutional right to arms. This is all it says under pro-life. Ready? I believe that life begins at contraception, period. That's it. That's all. That's,
I mean, he's
that's
not trying to attract Democrats.
No, he's not.
That stance is gonna stand true with conservatives like until the end of this reign. Like, that's not gonna change amongst them, I don't think. So I think he's playing his cards right. I didn't expect anything different from him. I feel like he's more of a Trump candidate in that he's being blunt about what he's saying. But then again, like, that worked 4 years ago, so. Who's to say it won't work now?
Well, the thing is, it worked 4 years ago, but it didn't work 1 year ago. It didn't work in Georgia 1 year ago. So this is my concern. And this is the only part of his webpage or any Republican webpage or any single piece of legislation that I care about right now, like with my whole heart. It's always this stance on election security, and it's something that I think is slipping under the radar. I don't know if we talked about it last time, but it's slipping under the radar of a lot of Americans. Listen, if we get Georgians to go out and vote and we don't have Republicans blocking their votes or purging them from, you know, what's it called? The voter rolls. Then Warnock and Ossoff will win again. If we can get the voting out, Warnock and Ossoff will win again. And it's very apparent. No, it's extremely obvious. The only reason Republicans win in Georgia and continue to win in states like Texas is because of the fact that they create literal electoral fraud. They create it through the forms of like voter ID laws. They create it through the forms of election conspiracy. They create it directly when you put a one county limit on, you know, the boxes where you can drop your mail ballots when you have counties that are of different sizes. It's not proportionate. And of course, bigger cities are going to have minorities and they're going to have more progressive individuals. So how are you going to have one place to vote in bigger cities? So that's the thing that I'm scared about in terms of the next election. Well,
yeah, why I said like I was kind of wincing when you said that they would win is because I think a lot of Democrat seats are up for contention just because of what Biden has not been able to do. If you look at the infrastructure bill that was supposed to pass a couple of days ago, the progressive side of the Democratic Party paused it. They were saying they couldn't vote for it because of Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema's opposition to their climate change and spending bill, which was worth $1.5 trillion. So I think a lot of why Biden might not be able to retain his seat and people who are under him, like congressional and Senate people, couldn't retain their seat, may not be able to, is because of the fact that we're not able to have progress on these action items that only require all Democrats and independents to vote for it, which is not that hard of a thing to ask for. But I think one of the issues I see right now is that progressives, I get what they're doing. I get that they're trying to get, you know, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema to acquiesce to their demands and to say that they're not going to just do whatever they want to do. But I think as of now, halting a bill that could actually create progress, create money, and create a lot of good things for a lot of Americans is just kind of irresponsible. I think Biden chose to do it in two parts just because he thought that the second part, the climate change and spending bill, probably could not pass amongst Manchin and Sinema. It would take more time to pass. And I think that was strategic, and it was a good idea because he needs something to show voters come the runoff elections and come his own election. I think he needs some tangible proof, and that would have been it. But I disagree with the fact that progressives are stopping progress on this thing just because they want to have both things passed at once. Because progress is progress, and as, you know, as Jake Tapper said to Nancy Pelosi during an interview When she was trying to advocate for more of a COVID bill, more money in the COVID bill a couple months ago, he said, "Perfect is sometimes the enemy of progress." That's not an exact quote, but it's something like what he said. And I think that applies here, just because we would all like to have 3.5 or whatever the money is, $1 trillion in our bill. But the issue is that Manchin and Sinema are not going to be turned in a couple of weeks. It's going to take them much longer. And I think that if we can pass one part of this bill, it will pacify a lot of Americans, increase Biden's approval ratings, and also increase Democrats' chances at congressional and Senate seats by the time they have they're up for election. And I just think that it's irresponsible for progressives to be pausing it in this moment.
Yeah. And you said that we were going to disagree on this issue, and you were 1,000% right. I disagree with the fact that we should pass it in two parts. I disagree with the fact that we should cut it. And I disagree with the statement that this is what most Americans want. What most Americans want is what's in the $3.5 trillion proposal. And you're talking about one way to get this thing passed, which is, you know, splitting it in two parts, getting some political clout, getting this thing up. But I always heard that, you know, as Americans, we don't negotiate with terrorists. And right now, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema are the terrorists of the Senate. They're terrorizing, and this is like the direct, you know, they're holding the Senate hostage. They're using political advocation to hold the Senate hostage. They're not doing what their constituents want. They're not doing what the American people want. And instead of whipping them, as I talked about, you know, on the last podcast, and saying, all right, you guys are going to play this game. We have, you know, 48 other Democrats and millions of Americans. We'll take you guys out. We'll whip you. We'll put you into form, and we'll get you to pass the $3.5 trillion. They're negotiating with them. And instead of trying to represent all of the Americans, a lot of the Senate, the Progressive Caucus, which the Progressive Caucus alone has more members than the people, you know, holding this bill from being passed, we're negotiating with them, and we're trying to succumb to their needs. It's not even their needs, it's just their wants. They're just trying to pull our legs, and they're trying to pull the American people's legs. Something that I think that was overlooked. Did you hear about the Hyde Amendment?
Yeah, the Hyde Amendment. Yep.
So the Hyde Amendment talks about Medicare not paying for abortions, and the Progressive Caucus is very strongly against this. And this is the things that get slipped in these infrastructure bills that in years to come are going to bite us in the ass, because that's going to be the law. That's going to be the, you know, the standard. And when we try changing it, it's going to be extremely difficult. And you're going to have future politicians doing things like that. For those of you that don't know, essentially the effects of this Hyde Amendment saying that Medicare will not pay for abortions, it's just going to affect people of lower socioeconomic status. Because people that can afford abortions aren't even going to listen to Texas's abortion laws. You can create a nationwide ban. People that can afford abortions are going to go to another country. There's always going to be solutions for people with money. The only thing that is the only individuals that are affected are the American population that can afford, you know, to have an abortion.
Yeah. So my perspective on this is a little bit different. The only reason why is because I just think that if we don't have an actionable plan passed by the next election for Congress and the Senate, we're not going to be able to win seats. And that's going to basically incapacitate us when it comes to solving issues like this in the future. I think that for us to have a good front to the American people when Biden's approval ratings are so low as it is right now, almost a level of Trump's approval ratings last year, we have to have something to remedy that. And I think remedying that begins with passing a bill which is $1.5 trillion. That's not a lot of money, but I think it does solve some issues with infrastructure, and it solves a lot of problems Americans are facing right now. I think it's not exactly what Americans want, but it is part of what Americans want. And I think that with time, we're going to be able to pass the $3.5 trillion or $3 trillion resolution that Biden and the Democrats are proposing. But I think that if we take this stance, if we're going to hold Joe Manchin hostage, which works for Joe Manchin because he's a centrist and he has the ability to do that. The only issue is Joe Manchin can walk away right now, and there is nothing any of us can do to stop it. If we keep playing
there is,
this game,
though.
Joe Manchin's
going to
keep...
They're totally...
Let me just... There was a news conference today.
Sure.
And Joe Manchin was talking, and he said, if you keep holding me hostage, I have no inclination to support your bill. I do not care. I could care less, and I'm not going to vote for it. And so I think with a person like Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, who do not have any inclination to vote for the bill unless you compromise with them, I don't think it's going to work just because they have the political savvy to say no, or the political power to say no. Manchin can say no and still win votes because his people, like you said last time, they're extremely centrist or conservative people. Sinema doesn't want to run for re-election, probably. She can afford to say no. So no matter what we do, they're still going to say no, in my opinion. And the only way for progress is to pass things that do appease them, even though it's not the best thing for us. I think it's the way for us to win seats in the future, and also to pass some kind of a reform for Americans. And I just think that right now, as a huge pragmatist, I know it's ideal for us to pass 3.5, and it sounds reasonable for us to kind of bully them into you know, doing what we want them to do. But I think these people are just, they have enough power, they have enough support to where they don't have to do what progressives want. And I don't see any way that you know, I guess gatekeeping them from doing anything would help us, because they're just not going to move. They're not going to change on their stances.
Well, I think it helps us in the terms that we're not going to get a shitty $1.5 trillion infrastructure bill that we're not even going to be able to flex. What are we going to flex?
I think it's part of a bigger package, though.
But everything that's good in it, everything that we wanted to flex, you know, paternity leave, maternity leave. We wanted to flex environmental changes. We wanted to flex, what was the other thing? Wages increasing, you know, economic rebound. Everything that we wanted to flex is gone. It's gone in the bill. It's gone with the $1.5 trillion. And instead, it's being replaced with things like the Hyde Amendment and all of these other ridiculous demands. So what is the benefit of saying that we passed $1.5 trillion? Because from my understanding, we're not going to get anything from it. We're not going to be able to say, look, this is what we did. And on the contrary, Republicans are going to do what Republicans always do, because it doesn't matter if they're right or wrong. They have this political position. And I always remember my sixth grade teacher said this. He said, if you want to keep control, if you're a government entity and you want to keep control, keep the people dumb. And the Republicans have managed to keep their constituents, or the individuals voting for them at the very least, dumb. And they're going to say that, you know, Democrats put us $1.5 trillion in debt. And there's going to be no rebuttal to that. You can't say, oh, yeah, well, you know, $1.5 trillion, but Americans got healthcare. Americans got better actual infrastructure, which is crumbling. Americans got, you know, paternity and maternity leave. The environmental crisis is being managed. You're not going to have any of these responses. All you're going to have is, yeah. And if anything, you're going to have Republicans saying that they got things like the Hyde Amendment into the infrastructure bill because they stood their ground, and that they're going to stand their ground, you know, for their constituents and whatnot.
Yeah. I was reading an article right now about the Hyde Amendment, because I wasn't sure about the fact that Biden had supported it, which I knew in his campaign trail.
Initially, he did.
He was going to repeal it. On October 5th of this year, apparently Joe Manchin said he would be opposed to the, us taking out Hyde Amendment from that infrastructure package. But Jen Psaki said that the president opposes the Hyde Amendment.
Yep.
It has not changed. And then Senate Democrats then again ditched the Hyde Amendment for the first time in decades. So I think that Biden has been taking a stance against the Hyde Amendment, but I could be wrong, but that's what I read.
But as you were saying, no. So Biden initially on the campaign trail, he was like, yeah, I support the Hyde Amendment, whatnot. Then he took a step back and said that he didn't support the Hyde Amendment. Yeah. And now that's his stance. His current stance is that he doesn't support the Hyde Amendment, but Joe Manchin is doing what you said he's going to do. He's going to say, well, I don't care. I want the Hyde Amendment in. I want it in. And I'm not gonna, that's why I'm talking about the fact that we just need a whip, because at the end of the day, he's gonna get whatever he wants inside that bill, and he's gonna be able to in turn bring home the bacon, you know, this political term where you bring back what your constituents want. He's just gonna get Republican votes, and we're gonna keep Joe Manchin in his seat. And I know this is gonna sound like a really damn hot take. I'd rather Joe Manchin lose his seat to a Republican then keep him in his position as a Democrat. Because at this point, he is a Democrat. I mean, he is a Republican.
Yeah, but here's the issue with that standpoint, in my opinion. I think that the problem is, if you don't give Joe Manchin bacon, you also don't give any Democrat bacon to bring home. And in my opinion, that means a lot of Democrats are going to lose.
What can Democrats bring home from the $1.5 trillion?
there's, I don't know exactly what's the exact provisions in it, but there's a bunch of stuff I read about earlier that, that help Americans. But I have to look into the actual provisions of it. But I know more about the spending and climate package. But we can look into the provisions.
Yeah, we'll look into the provisions next time. I think right now, go ahead. Mm-hmm.
I think the climate and spending one's also a big thing because, as you were saying before, I wanted to follow back on that, that a lot of the things that Democrats ran on, they're not going to be able to follow through on. For example, with the idea of, you know, lower drug prices for a lot of these expensive drugs, Democrats do have an amendment or a part of the spending and climate change package, which is worth like $1.5 trillion, talking about decreasing drug prices, but it's not nearly as comprehensive as what Joe Biden and the Democrats proposed before. One of those provisions is that elderly people are not going to have to pay more than $15,000 per month on their medical bills, which is something because a lot of them are paying more than $15,000, and it's a lot of people are paying like $20,000 or more.
Only
like
in America, but
and
it's
I think progress is progress, and I think that that's something, but it's not nearly as much as we promised. But then on top of that, we have some regulations giving us the ability to regulate the price of some lower cost drugs, but it doesn't, you know, stop the cost of these higher priced drugs, which are the ones that are causing the problems. The only issue is that Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema are opposed to it. Without those two people, we'll be completely fine. And I just think that it's every single year there's something messing up Democrats from having progress, and now it's these two blue dog Democrats. And I just think that it's so unfortunate for us. But with the climate idea, I wanted to talk about what Biden said at his conference, I believe, in Europe. I think it was a couple of days ago. He was talking about climate change and how the United States had promised to go towards decreasing their emissions from 50% from what it was in 2007 in 2050. And so his idea, he was saying that he was asked about how why the U.S. was promoting more oil production by Middle Eastern countries, even when it was saying we should decrease climate change across the world. And Biden's response to that, which is kind of controversial, he was saying that right now, the entire U.S. and the entire world depends on oil. And one of the issues for my consumers is that if we increase gas prices by telling people to stop producing oil or stopping the production of oil, that's going to cause economic difficulties for a populace that's suffering right now. The working class is going to be harmed by rising gasoline prices. And as it is right now, we don't have enough renewable output to support the world on just solar and wind and nuclear and those types of energies. So that was his stance. His stance was that we can't shift right now, but we're setting the stage to where we can shift maybe in 15, 20 years to a stance where we're totally renewable. And a lot of environmentalists agree, but some environmentalists do disagree. So
what's your stance?
I wanted to hear your take on my stance. I've advocated for this, like you probably garnered it, but I've advocated for this since the beginning. I think that I've read a bunch of Al Gore, and I think it's very pragmatic for us to consider that right now, if we do move 100% towards renewables and stop producing oil, that's literally going to hurt a lot of Americans economically. And that's something we don't want to do right now. But I think laying the stage for us to be completely independent on renewables in 2050 or 2060, that's going to allow us to become, you know, much better then. But I think doing it right now is kind of reckless. It may help the environment, but it's not going to help our people. And in the moment, it's going to cause a lot of difficulties for a lot of families. And I think that the best thing we can do right now is by minimizing, here's what I'm going to say, minimizing the environmental effect of our challenges while also minimizing the effect upon families and setting the stage for a future where we can have more renewable jobs. And that's my stance as more of a pragmatist person.
Well, this is what, and in turn, I kind of get what you're saying, but this is what drew me away from the Democratic Party and what drew me further to the left. And maybe I only realized it as I became a Democratic Socialist, but I hate the fact that the Democratic Party and the Republican Party obviously does this too. If I'm going to shit on the Democratic Party for doing it, just it goes without saying that the Republican Party does the equivalent or worse. I hate that they use the working class when it's convenient. You know, coming from a socialist where we all advocate for the working class, it's so annoying when it's convenient because they're saying that they don't, you know, if we raise gas prices, it's going to hurt the working class. You know what else hurts the working class? $600 insulin. You know what else hurts the working class? Food deserts. You know what else hurts the working class? Not having a $15 minimum wage. All of these things hurt the working class. You know what else hurts the working class? Expensive college that inhibits them from being able to change their socioeconomic status. and you know, refunding the police, as some of these Republicans are talking about. So I think it's really annoying that Democrats talk about how they want to create change, but essentially it just becomes all talk. So I really want to see, because I don't understand why we can't, you know, this might be like one of those, people that's like anti-economy, and they're just like, why can't we print more money? But my stance is, why can't we just fund it? Why can't we just give subsidies? Why can't we just,
subsidies are happening. That's, we're not cutting subsidies. What he's saying is he's promoting oil production in the Middle East.
Yeah, I get that.
He's telling them we're going to help you. Yeah.
Why can't we just change to other forms of power now, as we have been, as other countries have done, and we have the funds to do it? Hell yeah, we have the funds to do it. We have the funds to spend $600 billion on a stupid military.
Not overnight.
Oh yeah, not overnight, like not over 25 years.
What I mean is, like, 10 years is reasonable for us to increase our renewables.
And I think I agree.
25 years, believe it or not, that is what I think we need to go towards 100% electric. Because if you look at our society right now, we're dependent upon fossil fuels, like 100%.
Yeah.
Like, no, not 100%, like the 70% or 80% something like that. But I think we need 25 years to completely transition, and that's at the best estimate. Like, even the best environmentalists say it's only plausible for us to do that in 25 years. And I think what you're saying could work if we had a completely progressive, a completely leftist government. But we don't. And our populace also isn't completely
leftist. Not yet.
To be honest with you, a lot of our people don't even believe in climate change. So, I mean, like, we have to find a way to do it in a way that keeps Democrats in their seats. And one of the issues with Biden, and if he did choose to decrease oil production or not increase oil production in this moment, is that increasing gasoline prices.
Yeah.
That thing is going to drive away both Democrats and Republicans. And
it's
that
driving me away.
Maybe.
We're not driving anywhere with these damn gas prices, actually.
Yeah.
It's not going to drive us away. We're going to have to walk away.
Yeah. And the goal for Biden and a lot of environmentalists is, I don't believe it's Biden, just Biden, but a lot of environmentalists. Yeah. They think it's possible for us to go towards no more gasoline vehicles on the road, not on the road, but no new gasoline vehicles by 2035 or so. And so we can't produce any more of those vehicles, which is totally achievable because companies like Nissan and Toyota,
they're all changing.
They're all changing with the tides. And then the other thing I was kind of hinting at this earlier was that if Biden even does anything to hurt the oil industry, it's going to cost him lots of votes. And in turn, what is that going to do? Lead to a person like Trump getting elected and screwing all the progress we've had over the past 4 years up. And that's how fragile our environmental policy is. If one guy who is a hothead gets up there and tries to change it, we're pretty much fucked. Well, like, there's nothing
we
can do about it.
It all starts to what, going back to what we were talking about earlier. It's because we give validity to these politicians that are spewing BS. They're spewing BS. Joe Manchin is spewing BS, and we give validity to them. We engage in debates with them. We give them airtime. And if we really want to make progress, honestly, if we want to make true progress, one reason that it takes 25 years is because it takes us goddamn 30 years to build a nuclear power plant, which is annoying because we don't have infrastructure. And if you ask, what's his name? If you ask Jordan Peterson, he'll tell you it's because men are going, I don't even know what he sounds like, Kermit the Frog, goddammit, but I can't do it. It's because men are going on paternity leave is what he'll say. You know, men were working, then there wouldn't be a problem and we would have, you know, dams built in 5 years. But men decide to go on paternity leave. And people are like, he's right. Like, that's how dumb American people can be. This isn't even a political take. You know, you were talking about how I talked about critical race theory earlier. I said how that wasn't political. That's just factual. This is just factual. American people have brain disease sometimes.
Yeah.
It's like, how can you go to a guy that says, their argument is gay couples shouldn't be able to adopt because you need, like, you need a masculine father figure present while also advocating against paternity leave so that a masculine father figure can be present in the house. Like, it's such oxymorons. I this country could be Keeping Up with America. Like, I'm sure in Europe, instead of Keeping Up with Kardashians, it's Keeping Up with America. Like, we are a simulation. Like, there's no, you know, have you seen the videos that have come out of New York? like, I know you're not on TikTok anymore, but maybe some people get this reference. It's like these videos of like people just saying stupid things in New York, like the, you know, people in New York just like just being New Yorkers, and like all the comments are like, swear to God, New York is a GTA 5 lobby. That's what it's not New York. It's America. It's the whole United States. We are a massive GTA 5 lobby.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I get it. But then again, like, I think around the world, we've had some pretty riveting things happen, even in Europe. Like, for example, with the Brexit vote, that was something where we learned about the stupidity of people. Even with Trump's vote, these things are, they're revealing the stupidity and the impressionability of mankind, I think. It's kind of a bold statement, but I think that the Brexit vote, Trump's election, all these things have just been revealing how dumb we are, I think, a lot of times, and how untrustable both the American people and just people in general with their emotions are. And I think that we have to, Democrats in the next election, really have to capitalize upon what Trump did in 2016, which is rile up the emotions of people. So I think that that begins with, first of all, talking about issues like climate change, because climate change is a huge issue where if you get passionate about it, you're not going to stop. Like, if you learn about the fact that your Earth is going to burn up in less than a century, and we're going to have massive heat waves and stuff like that in a couple of decades, that's going to scare people. And I think that as bad as it sounds, scaring people with the facts is what I think we need to do. Because you know, people, Republicans talk about how Democrats spread fear, but really, climate change being a fact, we can spread fear now, or we can die with the consequences decades later. It's our choice. And we have to do it for our children, because in reality, reading about, you know, I've read a lot of Al Gore, I've read a lot of, you know, online stuff from the Environmental Protection Agency and stuff like that before Trump tainted it. But regardless, we don't have that much time. And the issue with climate change as a threat right now is because once we reach the point of maybe, I think it's 1.5 degrees Celsius climate change, there's not really a path for us to reverse the climate change that happens past that point. It's irreversible. So we can't do anything about that. But what we can do now between now and 2050 is stop us from getting to 1.5 degrees Celsius. And part of the issue with climate change is that
the higher we go in climate change, we got to convert it. Because American hogs,
there's so many
degrees Celsius to Fahrenheit. Yeah, that's 34 degrees Fahrenheit. So Americans.
Yeah.
You know, you were talking about fear.
There's one more thing about climate change I wanted to talk about before.
Go for it.
The curve of climate change has been pretty, kind of a little bit more linear in past years, but it's starting to become very, very exponential. Like, it's gonna go. Yep. It's going to curve very highly exponentially, just because if you look at the glaciers in Siberia, those things have methane underneath them. They're not glaciers. Yeah. Sorry. They're like permafrost. I mean, in Siberia, that has methane under it. And as the temperature continues to increase, we're going to have that permafrost melt. And that's going to be tons and tons and tons of methane into the atmosphere.
Which is going to cause, and that's going to be cause, perpetual. More.
It's going to be perpetual.
Yeah.
It's going to be more and more. Nobody discusses that fact. And also, we're seeing so many, you know, trees in the Amazon burn down because of various reasons, and one of them being climate change. But part of the issue with that is, what are trees? Trees absorb carbon from the atmosphere. The less trees we have because of deforestation and climate change, that's going to decrease sequestration abilities, more carbon. Yeah. So the exponential curve. And I think that makes me more scared, to where we don't have that much time to solve this, even less time than a lot of climate scientists predict. And we have to do something about it. But with the current political situation, we're not woken up yet. And there's so many signs in the air. But there's still people like that one senator we talked about last year, where he was bringing a snowball under the Congress building and saying that this is proof that climate change doesn't exist. You know, it's stupidity like that that makes me unfaithful in our you know, ability for progress in the future.
Yeah. And you're talking about how climate change is scary and how you're fearful, and we got to use fear. You know, we got to use facts, the fear in facts, to convince the American people. Well, something that is scary is Halloween. Halloween was yesterday. What did you do for Halloween?
I went to hang out with a couple of friends in the afternoon. I studied for most of the day because I spent Friday at a party for Halloween. So I wasn't studying much. But I chilled out. I handed out candy to a couple of kids in my house. But after a while, I got kind of lazy, and I just put the bucket outside of my house and let them pick up the candy for themselves.
There you
but
go.
It was a fun day. I mean, Yeah, it was a fun day. We have a big neighborhood where I live, so we had a lot of people coming by, and they took the candy, and it was really cool seeing people dressed up in costume. How about you?
I went to parties the whole weekend. I partied a lot this weekend. I had a lot of fun. I dressed up as a cholo.
What is that?
Like it's like a Mexican gangster.
Oh,
you
that's
haven't seen
cool.
them?
They're I was the, actually.
The, what were
yeah,
you?
I think I know what you're talking about. I think I know what you're talking about. But me and my friend Chuck, we were nurses because Chuck is actually a medical student. And so he just gave me one of his old scrubs, and I just wore that to a party. We got some fake blood and put it on top of our scrubs just to say we messed up in a procedure.
Yeah.
May or may not have been the case.
Well,
you know,
in honor of Halloween, I'm going to invite a new segment onto the podcast. I was talking to you about this, and I wanted it to be kind of Halloween themed. We were going to film yesterday, but we're filming November 1st, the day after Halloween. It's Dia de los Muertos, so, you know, it's still on theme. Everything's, you know, on topic here. And I want to introduce this new segment. It's called Story of the Week, and it's going to be something a little bit more chill back. It's going to be a little bit more fun. It's going to be a story that I bring to you, and we just kind of chat about it. To wrap up the podcast, in the middle of a podcast, to start the podcast, wherever it seems fit. So for the first ever story of the week, we have to go back 95 years. Harry Houdini was born on March of 1874 to Cecilia and Meyer Samuel Wise. Quickly, Houdini would gain a reputation as a famed illusionist, eventually earning the title Handcuff King. While we could go into the mystery of his illusions, on this segment, we will be talking about the mystery surrounding his death. One of the tricks he was known to have performed was being able to withstand a punch from any man. Wanting to test this ability, a medical student, you were talking about some medical students earlier, Jocelyn Gordon Whitehead asked Houdini if he was allowed to punch him in his abdomen. Harry Houdini nodded, and before he had a chance to brace his abdomen, Whitehead had punched him twice and was going in for a third punch, but Houdini caught it. Houdini was in physical pain, but nonetheless traveled to his performance 15 hours away the next day in Detroit. When he arrived there, Houdini was running a high fever and was promptly diagnosed with acute appendicitis. This was severe, and as such, the doctor on site called for an ambulance, but Houdini declined in order to proceed with his show, stating, "I'll do this show if it's my last." Well, it was. He was rushed to a nearby hospital to remove his already ruptured appendix and eventually would pass away at the age of 52 due to sepsis. His last words were known to have been, "I'm tired of fighting." He did, however, promise his wife that if he were to die first, he would send her a message from the afterlife. Unfortunately, no message was ever received. Scientific advancements have allowed us to conclude that despite popular misconception, it was likely not the punches from Whitehead that caused Houdini to die, but rather developing appendicitis, and the punches were just a coincidence. I like the way that this article that I was reading kind of ends and talks about Houdini's death, so I'm going to end it with their quote. "Just as with Houdini's spectacular escapes on stage, we will never really know how he escaped this life, or if he was able to escape to the next."
Mm. Cool story, man. I loved it. And I hope our viewers loved it too. It's pretty interesting. Pretty interesting.
Had you heard about Houdini before?
I did. I actually did. I heard about his death too. Because I read a lot about like last words of people.
Sure.
Like famous last words. And one of them that I read was Houdini's. And it was like, what do you say again?
I'm tired of fighting.
Yeah, there's tons of last words like that, which are really, really like just influential. And
a bunch of quotes.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of these quotes like this, why I read them is because I feel like I can learn a lot from people who are on their deathbed. Like, because they are reflecting upon their lives, and I feel like as a person who has a long life ahead of him, I want to learn from those people and really garner what they have to say before I go about my stuff. And one of those that really struck out to me was Steve Jobs. His last words were kind of simple for a guy that was so complex in the way he thought and acted. They were just wow. I think it was wow, wow, wow. Oh, wow. Oh, wow. Oh, wow. I think that's what it was. But it was like just a couple of words.
Yeah.
And he'd been suffering for a while, but I think he saw the beauty of life at that time. And this guy, if you know Steve Jobs, he was not a fan of anything almost, except it was, perfect. Like he was a very big perfectionist. He used to go to like a bunch of restaurants and just, you know, not pay for the food, throw away the food, stuff like that, because he didn't like the food. So I think a lot of what he did was perfectionism, and him saying, oh, wow, oh, wow, oh, wow. It's pretty cool to me, being a big, you know, Steve Jobs buff like that. So
he did have a lot of regrets on his deathbed, though, how like far away he was from his family.
Yeah.
He was a big capitalist, but ultimately he did pay the price of capitalism. You know, he worked hard. He worked his ass off. But he never really reaped the benefits of essentially being a capitalist. You know, the system is set up. We can talk about the problems with it and whatnot, but the system is set up for individuals to ideally succeed by being, you know, entrepreneurs and taking the risk of starting a business, and then, you know, reaping the benefits. And Steve Jobs had a lot of benefits that he never really reaped. He died young.
He could have lived on, actually, in my opinion. The reason why he died young, once again, was because he denied treatment. He was a big fruitarian. He only believed in eating fruits as a diet. And for that reason, he denied a lot of his treatments, and he only was treated for cancer later on. And that's why his treatment was not as successful as he thought it would be. But that was the reason why he died so young, because he denied treatment for that long, even though he could have afforded it because of, like you said, capitalism.
Well, isn't it kind of interesting that Houdini, you know, in both of these stories, we're drawing parallels here. Houdini also denied treatment, and he denied a lot of treatment. And it's like, I don't know what's up. I think it's a masculine thing. Like, I don't know if it's just guys, but like, we're so hesitant, I feel like, to go to doctors or to get treatment. I don't know if the statistics like change or back this up in like countries that have like healthcare or whatnot, actual healthcare, like affordable healthcare. I feel like guys are just more hesitant. It might just be American culture, but I think Houdini's story was interesting because I always thought, I don't know how much you knew about it. I think it's just cool because, you know, it's Halloween themed. Obviously, he was an illusionist, but I always thought that he did die from the punches. I thought that the punches did cause his appendix to rupture, but apparently we actually don't know like the cause of his death.
Yeah. Yeah, I had no idea that it was even like a punches that caused his death, really? Or appendicitis. I just heard about his last words. That's all I knew about it.
Oh, okay.
So I just love reading about those things. But yeah, it's a pretty cool story. We can definitely bring something in next time. That,
you know, one of my favorite last words was like this guy that was put on death row. I don't know why I always remember this, but this guy that was put on death row, and his last name was French, right? And he was like, he said something along the, this is like a complete paraphrase. He said something along the lines of like, oh boy, the news title's going to be interesting tomorrow, French fries, because he was on the electric chair.
Oh,
I'm just like, damn, how crazy do you have to be?
Yeah. I'm like a big buff for those things. So I heard about that one too.
That's an interesting thing about you though. You don't think that's a little creepy?
No, the reason why I do that is because I'm a big philosophy person. So I read a lot about like, you know, life, existentialism, the meaning of life, stuff like that. And I think that reading these last words of people helps me reveal, you know, what life meant to a lot of people. And it helps me, like I said before, frame my life. And I feel like it's really beneficial to me, because death is a topic that many Americans have a hard time, you know, talking about or thinking about. And I think confronting it like that will help you, I don't know, just be more comfortable with it.
Yeah, I think that's something that's very interesting about American culture is like this idea. Maybe we're stepping away from it a little bit. I think our generation in specific is stepping away from it a little bit. But like this idea that like death is like kind of like not talked about. Like you don't.
Yeah,
really,
it's a taboo.
You don't really. You know, it was, man, earlier in my psychology class, you know, the individual that teaches this class, awesome.
Oh, yeah.
in certain aspects, and then in other ways he's very unique. Someone was like not paying attention, and he was like, that's what's wrong with your guys' he was just in a bad mood, I think. He's that's what's wrong with your guys' generation, the lack of awareness. And I'm so worried that you guys are one day going to lead this country. And then he's like, but I'm not too worried about it because I'll be dead and gone by then. And like, think about it. It was 9 a.m. Like, this is the first class of the day. This was the first like three sentences that he said to us.
Oh my gosh, he's a funny guy. I think that he's pretty funny if you come to look at it like that. But
me and one of our friends were talking about how he's just like, he's an NPC.
Yeah, Yeah, literally. He's one of the most unique people I've met in my life.
Yeah.
But he's good for him, man. He's awesome.
I die of laughter. He's just a very how do we explain him to the podcast guests that wouldn't understand?
He's very funny, but I don't know if he means to be funny.
It's not purposeful. That's what it is. It's not purposeful. It's almost like his whole personality is satire.
Yeah. Like, you know one of the other teachers like we had, I don't know if you know who he was. He was an AP environmental teacher.
Webb?
A couple of years ago. Yeah, Webb.
Oh, shit. Yeah.
Yeah. Whoops. But Mr. Webb, he's really funny, but he gets that he's funny. Like, he's a dry humor, but he, like, always laughs after it. But this teacher, he doesn't laugh at all. Like, he's just,
he
stays stern-faced. Like,
yeah,
I've never seen
him
laugh. Like, I don't even know if I've seen him laugh before.
But
it's just, like, he just says the joke, and he just, like, just goes with it. It's not even a joke in his opinion, I don't think. But the whole class thinks it's a joke, and it's just kind of awkward after he says it, because there's no laughter that's happening.
Dude, yeah, I die laughing. I don't know. Maybe it's because I'm taking the class as a senior and I don't care.
I took it as a sophomore, so I don't laugh as much.
I don't care. Like, what's he going to do? Like, kick me out of the class? Like, I literally could care less about it. But no, I've enjoyed it. I've enjoyed this podcast with you. I think that we ended it on a really good note. This was a really good episode, to be honest. I'm really happy with this one.
Yeah.
What did you think about the segment? The story of the week?
I think it's very unique for our podcast, because we usually just have like an hour conversation about everything and no break really. And I think it's kind of brought a break to our podcast, and we hope you guys liked it. If you guys liked it, let us know over social media at Blitatine Show.
Look at you.
Or just let us know in person if you
Look
guys
you.
See us around.
Shouting out the I didn't even have to do it, but you know, like Varun said, if you do like what we're doing here on the podcast, if you have any suggestions, any comments, if you guys want to interact with us, you can do that on our social media at Blitatine Show on both Instagram and Twitter. You can check out our website. We're trying to get everything revamped, so be patient with us here in the next couple of weeks as we get the podcast back up and running. We're going to try to get everything situated for you guys, and we hope that you guys accompany us on this journey. And you guys accompanied us on this episode today if you did make it to the end, and we appreciate that. So once again, coming from both me and Varun, thank you for tuning into yet another episode of the Blitatine Podcast. Goodbye.